It's the Popmatic Podcast for September 10th, 2014. And like the man from another place says, that gum you chew is going to come back in style.
Gross.
Ew.
This is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Greg.
Crystal.
Mike.
Amanda.
And the gum you chew is going to come back in style because today is Critical Rehab. What is Critical Rehab?
That's a good question.
Exactly. It's when we critically rehabilitate some books, movies, and music that maybe snobby critics, or maybe even ourselves, just didn't like when they first came out. But then... You know, some time went by, and we reevaluated.
Show is not about drug addiction.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, you know, you let bad celebrities go into rehab and have critics make fun of them.
Which is what I thought the episode was about.
Good. 5 stars.
Okay, so we've done this theme once before, and that was back in August 2011, but we called it Things We've Fallen Back in Love With, if you remember that episode.
That was a good one.
Now, the occasion... for revisiting this theme is that the library is going to show Sorcerer as part of our Movies at Main program. And Crystal has some information about that.
All right. This Saturday, September 13th, beginning at 2 p.m., Movies at Main needs 4 people willing to drive a cargo of death to escape a life in hell.
Not it.
A little too stressful chore for the weekend, perhaps? Well, how about watching the movie with that plot instead? William Friedkin's 1977 film Sorcerer, originally dissed by critics, is now considered to be a true classic. See it on our big screen, Saturday, September 13th, 2 p.m., in the Main Library Auditorium. And don't miss Bill's Legends of Film interview with the film's editor, Bud Smith, available for streaming or downloading anytime. Now back to you, Brian.
So... the Bud Smith interview was spectacular. It was really amazing. And the one thing that I would really like about Sorcerer is the way that the film is constructed. They don't make films like that anymore. I think it leaves it up to the viewer to put it together. Now, Bill, if he was here, he would definitely be like, it is super exciting. There's a scene on the bridge and a big truck. And just me personally, I don't care so much about that, but I love the way that that movie is put together. And that's what makes it so great. And if I wanted to talk to a film editor, it would be the film editor who edited that movie. And Bill did for the library, and it's great. And Sorcerer is a great movie. Don't miss it.
But there's no Sorcerer in the movie, just to clarify.
I'm not going to give that spoiler away. Soundtrack by Tangerine Dream when they were still good. And I think we're probably going to project it on Blu-ray, so it's going to be like the Sorcerer Tangerine Dream soundtrack in awesome surround sound coming out of that Blu-ray. And it's, yeah, that's like, that's free, kids. What else are you going to do? That is, you need to do that.
Okay. Although the name is actually taken from the Miles Davis album called Sorcerer.
Really?
Thank you, Wiki.
I didn't know that. Because that does, I mean, that does reference one thing, that like a plot point in the movie, but I don't want to spoil what it is. All right, first, Amanda, what are you going to critically rehab?
Well, so it's not always movies or, like, full plot lines that get rehab. Sometimes it's characters. And so today I present to you the top 5 characters that almost weren't. And these are from TV shows that National Public Library does have. So if you are afraid you would miss these characters, they're still there and you can watch them. So number 5 is Luke Danes, played by Scott Patterson from The Gilmore Girls. Originally, Luke was only supposed to be in the pilot episode. He's the diner owner. But he and the star, Lauren Graham, who played Lorelai, had such great chemistry that they ended up keeping him. And now I can't even imagine no Luke and Lorelai on the Gilmore Girls. He's probably my 2nd favorite character. So that kind of blew my mind. I didn't know that one. Number 4 is Sophia Petrillo, played by Estelle Getty from The Golden Girls. Thank you for being a friend. And she was only supposed to appear in the pilot, I assume, just as a passing, you know, Dorothy's mom comes through. But she proved so popular that, you know, they kept her, made her a series regular. And I didn't realize this, that she was replacing a gay chef named Coco, who was supposed to be the fourth member of the regular cast. So,
wow.
Sorry, Coco.
That's the best factoid we've ever seen.
I know, right? You can't beat that. So, number three is Jack Shepard, played by Matthew Fox, from the TV show Lost. And so, not only was he not supposed to survive the pilot, he wasn't supposed to play Dr. Jack at all. It was actually supposed to go to Mr. Mom star Michael Keaton.
Batman himself.
Batman himself was supposed to be Dr. Jack Shepard, but he turned down the role. And then the J.J. Abrams had written Jack to die halfway through the series premiere, but then with Matthew Fox, he kept him for five seasons and he became one of the leaders of the show. So it would be interesting to see how they originally planned it. Maybe it would have been better.
Beetlejuice would have been amazing.
Mike sold on.
Yeah, Michael Keaton. I want to go to this parallel universe where he said yes.
Yeah, maybe it would have ended better and we would know what's going on.
That's right.
Anyway, number two is Sheldon Cooper, played by Jim Parsons from The Big Bang Theory, which this one blows my mind. Sheldon was just supposed to be the quirky roommate to Johnny Galecki's Leonard. Like, he was supposed to be the main character. It was supposed to be all about him and Penny, and Sheldon was just this quirky guy. But Sheldon proved so popular with audiences that now he's basically the feature of the show. He's the one that's won all the Emmys. He's the one that people tune in to see and talk about, and everybody else has kind of gotten pushed to the side. So that one kind of was amazing. And then my number one character was actually the reason that I thought about this in the first place, was Spike, played by James Marsters from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I actually knew this as it was happening, but Marsters shares the story. Spike was just supposed to be in three episodes, but they did three episodes and then he didn't die. And then they did two more and he didn't die. So he just kept going. And then the script for the fifth episode, he gets, like, this whole organ collapses on top of him. And he thought, yep, that's it, I'm dead. But if you watch Buffy, you know he didn't die. They keep sending him scripts. And then Spike actually became one of the cornerstone characters of the Buffy series. He actually spun off with Angel when they did the Angel series. Spike went with him. Spoiler alert, he saves the day a couple times. He's still in the comic books as they continue season 8 and season 9 past that. So he's definitely my favorite Buffy character. So top five characters that almost weren't, but fan loyalty saved them.
That's a crazy list because all of those people, if you think about those shows, like, they're central.
Or major characters. Yeah. Yeah, and then they were, like, almost didn't make it past the pilot.
Yeah, Chris Pratt in Parks and Rec was supposed to be, like, a really minor character, and then he got written to the show, too.
Really impressed with your research this week, Amanda.
Yeah,
thank
yeah.
you. I didn't mean to do math, but I did everything else. So.
Yeah, make me look good. Or bad. So, I was going to talk today about H.P. Lovecraft and the Library of America. Ooh. So, I guess I'll start out with my feelings on H.P. Lovecraft. He was, like, the most influential American horror writer between Edgar Allan Poe and Stephen King. Basically invented the idea of cosmic horror, where there's, like, aliens that are so alien that we cannot comprehend them. You know, that their motives are completely unknown. We're like ants to them. You know, everything else before that was like, you know, humanity is really important and like, you know, the anthrocentric point of view, as it were. But he was kind of the first to go like, no, you know, aliens are alien, which makes it like infinitely more creepy to me. And I also thought you know, it's not really touched upon, but like I think it's kind of neat that he had a very extensive social network with all the writers of all types and ages and stuff. And he influenced like a lot of them. Like they would ask him to write stories in his style or use some of his characters or motifs. And he would always say yes. And he would like give them suggestions about how they could use it. And he would use their ideas and his stuff. And it was very like, you know, give and take. And I thought that was like a cool idea and kind of like a precursor to like the internet nowadays, you know, where like, you know, authors pay attention to their fans, that sort of thing. In fact, for the last couple of years of his life, he gave up writing altogether and just focused on writing professionally. And he wrote letters, pretty much, I mean, like thousands of them, including, I guess the most famous person he wrote to is Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho. But, you know, he wrote people that you've not heard of that I enjoy, like Henry Kuttner, that sort of thing. I mean, Joyce Carol Oates, of all people, said something to the effect, I tried to find the exact quote today, but I could not find it, but she said that the best time to discover H.P. Lovecraft is around the age of 13, which is exactly when I discovered him. I thought it was like, it blew my like young mind, that kind of, you know, cosmic, ooh, scary. Although I didn't really like, you know, I've still never really enjoyed like his prose, you know, like why does he keep saying Cyclopean instead of, like, gigantic. You know, why? But, you know, I just like the crazy monsters. But in the literary universe, like, you know, outside of the science fiction horror genre ghetto, yeah, he's considered something of a joke because, like, most of his plots are kind of the same. You have to use, like, a dictionary to figure out what he's saying. You know, I mean, I've heard that they, like, some literary snobs, like, playing party games where they try to, like, you know, make up stories in his style and giggle. Now let's go talk about, you know, books about where people just talk about sex for 300 pages. So I was really super surprised when a book called Lovecraft Tales came out, published by the Library of America, edited by Peter Straub. The Library of America is this big nonprofit organization that produces high-quality books of, you know, esteemed literary merit. Each book is designed to last generations, and they have the price tag to show for it. Oh, yes. You know, do you want to pay $30 for, you know, a book by Ulysses S. Grant? Sure. For a long time, they published only, like, you know, stuff you'd expect, like Henry David Thoreau or Nathaniel Hawthorne or Herman Melville, or other boring writers that had to suffer reading in high school because that I'd rather gargle Drano than endure reading for fun. That's right. Yeah, throwing down the gauntlet.
Apparently, you've never gargled Drano.
The horror. I've heard it's quite tasty. The antifreeze, I've heard, is pretty good. Anyway, But I guess they ran out of, like, snooty literary old-timey people because they started publishing stuff that I didn't want to read, like Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. And then, hey, H.P. Lovecraft. And recently, they've been publishing Brian's homeboy, Philip K. Dick, and, you know, esteemed, you know, thick literary editions. Also, I mean, I should say something that he's also, if you're thinking of reading him, he's also unbelievably racist. So, you know, watch out, guys. Like, apparently, like, the worst thing in the universe is having sex with fish people, which was code for something else. So just as a kind of FYI, you know, there's been stuff written lately that, you know, is too much out of the purview of this podcast about some of his beliefs, and it's been making me think about certain things. But, you know.
It comes up every couple years, right?
Yeah.
So I think besides the cash cow aspect of publishing Philip Dick and Lovecraft, I think what it's about is cultural influence, not necessarily literary merit, because such aesthetic things are relative. And PKD and Lovecraft, they're just cultural influences, really, really deep and really permeating. And if you're talking about from a cultural studies perspective, is like really influential writer. You know, I think it's historically important. And then it also, more cynically, if they publish popular authors,
then Dorks Like Me will actually buy their books.
It makes them a lot of money. Because even, like, for instance, if you wanted to buy a book that you were going to keep on your shelf, like the PKD collections, they're not as cool looking as the old paperbacks, but you could buy one or two volumes, you get his best novels from the 60s, his best novels from the 70s, and they're hardbound and are elegant. So
yeah, I really liked the Year's Best Horror Collections that were edited by Carl Edward Wagner, which I'm probably going to mention next month for Shocktober. Stay tuned, listeners. But in one of the introductions to a volume in the 70s, he's mentioning that this crazy new writer named Stephen King is coming out, and finally we're getting rid of all these crappy Lovecraft pastiches. That was what horror was from, like, the 30s to, like, the 70s, was people trying to rip off Lovecraft, and maybe this crazy new kid named Stephen King
could do something interesting.
Well, you know, reinvigorate the genre.
I just, you know, what's the name of his most famous monster?
Cthulhu,
right?
Yeah.
And if you guys have ever seen that name, Cthulhu, and say, what the heck is that? That's Lovecraft's most famous monster, and it's like the big thing with the squid head with the tentacle mouth.
One of the things I love about Lovecraftian stuff is you could go to a con, and that's like the one thing that, like, nerds are into that, like, the normals have no idea about. Like, you don't really see, like, Cthulhu anywhere else but, like, at, you know, conventions or anything. You know?
I don't know. For me, I think it's kind of crossed over, but maybe I'm, like, so far in nerd world that I don't, like...
No, I mean, I never thought I'd see a movie with, like, Gamora, the most dangerous woman in the galaxy, of Ronan the Accuser, and that came out 3 weeks ago, and is the most, you know, popular movie of the year. So, you know, things can change, I guess. Anywho, what do you got, Crystal?
All right, so I'm going to start with sound bites from a negative review of a particular album, and see if you can guess the name of the band and the album. Weak, unimaginative, dull, redundant, foppish, prissy. Those descriptors were taken from journalist, writer, and musician John Mendelsohn's March 1969 Rolling Stone review of Led Zeppelin's eponymous debut album. All I have to say to Mr. Mendelsohn is, where is your Kennedy Center honoree medal?
Bam.
Oh.
Play the music.
Burn.
Oh, so recorded this album on their own dime, shopped it to Atlantic Records, and got signed. It's mostly a live album Jimmy Page produced using some of the tricks he discovered during his days as a session player. He was one of the first producers to record a band's ambient sound. Producers usually kept the microphones directly in front of the amps and the drums, but Page put another mic further away from the amp and recorded the balance between the two. On You Shook Me, Page used the backwards echo, another studio trick he claims that he innovated. You hear the echo before the main sound instead of after. I've already given you a taste of essential tracks, Communication Breakdown, and You Shook Me. My personal favorite off this record is Dazed and Confused. It takes me back to that old couch where I'm staring at the Fractal poster every time. And I totally mean that in a good way.
Groovy.
Led Zeppelin remains number 29 on Rolling Stone's list of the top 500 albums of all time. It was reissued in June of this year in a deluxe edition, remastered by none other than Jimmy Page. All 9 of Zepp's studio albums are getting this treatment. You can listen to the original album and check out the reissue, which includes live tracks from a show in Paris in 69. And those are available on Hoopla, and we'll link to that in the show notes. All right, Brian.
Back to Led Zeppelin. If I'm not mistaken, I think that there were a lot of Led Zeppelin albums that were panned by critics. Like,
sure.
1, 2, 3... You know, I don't think it was till like 4 when critics were finally like, yeah, I have to admit that this, these are a lot
of...
I guess
the these are okay. All
of them. Houses of the Holy, Physical Graffiti. Yeah. Like, nobody no critics like those.
They're like, oh, this is like Lord of the Rings, like, rock.
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, nothing. That's right.
Nerd rock.
Misty Mountain Hop.
And I mean, as a testament to, like, you know, how they're received these days, I went and saw them last winter with the Nashville Symphony, and that's, like, you know, the studious way you can see a rock and roll band. But I didn't see the real Led Zeppelin,
I was going to say.
It was a very compelling cover band.
I would have left my hermit cave to go see that.
Wait, they both came out?
Two zombies and two dudes, cool.
Snootiest way you can listen to see a rock band is at home alone with like 5.1 surround mix, super CD. That's the...
If you do the geometry and figure out the sweet spot where you need to sit.
That's the snobbiest way you get to listen to a Zeppelin record. I'm supposed to talk next. All right.
So enthused.
We get better at this as we go along.
I talk now.
I want to talk about this movie, Only God Forgives. It came out in 2013, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. It's a slow boil crime drama set in Bangkok, Thailand. Currently, it has a 40% rating by critics on Rotten Tomatoes and a 37% audience rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So most people did not like this movie.
Wowzers.
It's funny, though, because it actually stars Ryan Gosling and an unrecognizable Kristen Scott Thomas. And forgive me, I'm going to screw up this guy's Thai name, but Vidhya Pansringarm plays Chang, the Thai detective. How it starts is Gosling and his brothers are these Americans that own a kickboxing club in Bangkok, but really it's just a front for their drug operation. And then one of the brothers goes on a bender and murders this Thai girl. So this hard-boiled Thai detective shows up. And he gives some vigilante justice to the murdering brother. And then Gosling's mother arrives, played by Thomas, and she demands that Gosling seek vengeance on her brother's murderer. But he doesn't really want to do this because, like, well, you know what? He gruesomely murdered this teenage girl. And so if he went out and got killed after that, I don't really care. But Gosling and Thomas's mother and son relationship is, how shall we say, kind of gross. And she's like, no, you're going to do it. And he doesn't want to do it, but he does it anyway. And then the rest of the movie is the showdown between Gosling and Pansringarm.
Ask him why he killed my brother.
Did you get the guy that did it?
It's a little more complicated than that, mother.
He hasn't told you, has he? There was someone else involved. some cop. You can't go around killing cops anymore. You want to fight?
Normally, that's a sort of typical like crime setup that I wouldn't care about, and you know, Mike and Bill could go make some popcorn and hang out, right?
Yeah, so far I'm sounded interesting.
And really get into this
I've
movie.
Watched that.
It's really not my kind of thing, but it's shot very beautifully by Larry Smith. Like everything glows, every set is its own little world, and then the shots that are outside, like Bangkok, looks incredibly hot. Like I mean, like physically hot. It's just like it just seems like it's like 110 degrees all the time. And then it's also this really fascinating mixture of like realism and dreams. So a lot of the scenes, you're not sure if they're actually happening or whether the characters are imagining them or whether they're like dreams or they're just like symbolic on some other level. So it's like sort of operating on three levels, like reality and then dreams and then mythologically. This is a good example of this, a really obvious example of this is the detective Chang. He has this sword. When he uses the sword, it just appears. It's like, where did the sword come from? And there's this kind of obvious metaphor that he's the law with a capital L. He's the arm of the law. He's like the avenging arm of the law. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that's not your thing. I really liked it. I know that I just wanted to see it because Gosling was in it and I heard it had been panned. So I'm always interested in that when a big star is brave enough to do a movie that gets bad reviews. And actually, you know, it's one of those deals where I checked out from the library and it was due and I was like, crap, what am I going to do? So I just put it in the TV like as I was getting ready to go to work in the morning. And then I kept glancing at the screen and I was like, there's something going on in this movie that is more than just plot, right? Because like it would look and it was beautiful, but there were just things happening. It was like the director's trying, you know, for something big here.
He didn't come to work that day.
Yeah. Well, you ate the dollar late fee.
Well, yeah, exactly. So I ate. Well, in my case, I probably just got billed for it. But so I actually took the time to watch it, and I thought it was just totally amazing and fascinating. And then so the other big metaphor too for me was like the West versus Thailand. Or like the USA versus Thailand. I don't have any Thai friends. I really want to know what like Thai people think about this movie or what they think about, you know, this interpretation of the movie. So if you're Thai, you know, please leave your thoughts in the comments. But I think one of the big metaphors is like the West exploiting Thailand in particular, like for like sex tourism. The Chang character is like the law, is like his revenge on the West for that. You know, the big final fight scene or the big sort of climactic fight scene with Gosling and Panzeringarm is not your typical fight scene, and I loved it. I think some people might be disappointed, but I totally loved it, and it sort of builds up to that moment. And that music that they use in the trailer that you've probably heard is the music from that fight scene. Cliff Martinez is becoming one of the more sought-after film scorers out there today. And then, of course, the other thing that's really great about this movie is Kristin Scott Thomas is an awesome villain. Like, she is, like, creepy and evil to an uncanny degree, and she's totally unrecognizable. You wouldn't know that it's her. So definitely check it out. Only God Forgives.
So is there kickboxing?
Yeah,
is there kickboxing?
I to see it. To answer Greg's question, there is kickboxing. Because the
kickboxing, cool.
Well, there's a Muay Thai club, right? It's actually, I said I Americanized it as kickboxing.
Right? Sure.
But there's a Muay Thai club, and one of the things is that, you know, Gosling and his brothers are like the bosses of this club, and they treat like the young fighters kind of crappily, and their families kind of crappily. So that's like adds this whole other layer to the story. And then finally, like, well, this is a spoiler. What I'm going to tell Greg next. I'm going to cut it from the podcast. I enjoy the audaciousness of that. And the thing about Refn's movies that I come to enjoy is that he often strives. He's willing to take risks, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And for me, like Only God Forgives is the one movie of his where all the risks that he takes absolutely work. If you wanted a blurb, it's like Quentin Tarantino and Peter Greenaway had a baby.
Cool. Is that me?
Yeah, that you're next. I'm so used to going last that I thought I was last. But you told me you had a list of 17 movies, 17 albums.
Oh, yeah. I think it's... Ooh, might as well kick back.
More like 12. Getting back to The Sorcerer. I haven't seen The Sorcerer yet, but I'm going to go. But one thing that caught my eye in reading about it is that the soundtrack, which Brian mentioned, was done by the German music group Tangerine Dream. Tangerine Dream was highly influential on the development of psychedelic and krautrock, but the group later went on to basically pioneer the use of the analog sequencer that would later give rise to modern electronic music. Though they're definitely still not a household name, they remain highly critically acclaimed. Going off in a totally different direction, what this all makes me think about is all the pop stars and record producers of the 1980s that sort of leapt on this same technology and others and used it to sort of less effect than Tangerine Dream, often just dating the music and, you know, rendering it but beyond listenability to our modern ears. So one classic example of this are the albums that Bob Dylan made in the 1980s. Basically, the man has been making albums his whole life, switching and redefining genres at every turn. And they've all been critically acclaimed, except for every single one made in the 1980s, right? But of course, true Dylanites mine this material, and a certain 80s Dylan canon has emerged among true fans. Recently, I've come to appreciate this music, this era of Dylan, through reinterpretations by some of my favorite indie rock artists on an album that came out this year called A Tribute to Bob Dylan in the 1980s, Volume 1, presumably there will be more, which you can find on Hoopla. It features Built to Spill, The Hold Steady, Reggie Watts, M83, all these great bands coming together and making some of the best, or one of the best Dylan albums that he never made. Reggie Watts is definitely one of the wild cards on the album. He has this dubstepy version of Brownville Girl that is just this total reinterpretation of the song, unrecognizable from the original. And he makes it all the more amazing because he's doing it with his mouth. If you know Reggie Watts, that's kind of his thing, is that with like a loop pedal. So another quick example of this is a series that the AV Club used to do called AV Club Undercover.
Yeah. They might be giants to the cover of Tub Thumping. Very good.
Yeah. Random, like. Yeah. So they basically done, like.
Chubba Wubba, yeah!
Yeah. Speaking of people that were not recognized for their genius. So, yeah, the way it works is they would make, like, users would generate a list of songs that they wanted to see covered, and then they'd invite bands in to kind of just, like, scratch off at the list. So, like, once a song is taken, you can't do it again. Just a really random list of songs. But the one that I'm going to talk about is the Iron and Wine covering One More Try by George Michael of Wham. So Sam Beam of Iron and Wine and crew strip it down to just a few simple instruments, and it reveals this totally beautiful song underneath it all. Sam Beam could have just come in there and, like, done this, like, a total piss take on the song. But, you know, he's just like, nah, yeah, screw that, I'm just gonna do this straight. And it's like, it's totally a beautiful song.
Now I think it's time that you let me know. So if you love me, say you love me. But if you don't, just let me go.
If you're not into that, there's also Guar covering Kansas.
Yeah.
If that's more your speed.
But Amanda, what's tickling your fancy this week?
Okay, well, it's not really tickling my fancy. This has been my husband's favorite song on the radio for the last week, and it's called All About That Bass, and it's by Meghan Trainor, and it's been out since June, and it's been kind of the song of the summer. And honestly, I kind of think it sounds like she has a head cold.
Is it tickling your husband's fancy this week?
but I will say, it's kind of grown on me a little bit.
Because you know I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, bass. Yeah, it's pretty clear. I ain't no size 2, but I can shake it, like I'm supposed to do. 'Cause I got that boom boom that all the boys chasing. faces. I see the mag.
And she's not from Nashville. She grew up in Nantucket, Mass. But she has lived in Nashville since she was 19, and she actually wrote this song. It's not just she's a singing head that someone gave her words and she gets to sing them. So that kind of makes me like it a little bit more. And she signed to Epic, which means for our NPL fans that you can download both the song and the video on Freegle, which I watched this morning because I had no idea what she looked like, but it makes sense. The thing I like about this song and why it's growing on me a little bit is I like the combination of like the hip hop and then like the 50s like pop music. And you really wouldn't think that they work well together, but somehow she makes it work. Free to check her out. If you listen to the radio, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So Megan Trainor. And she's actually had other cuts with Rascal Flatts and other bands for songs that she's just written. And they're thinking her new album is going to come out sometime this fall.
Yeah, I bought a CD recently at The Great Escape. It was called Rebop, where it's modern hip-hop DJs remix like 40s jazz.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Yeah, it's actually, quite good.
It's either really cool or really bad. Yeah, those are your two options.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, $3. How bad could it be? That's actually pretty good.
For $3. Yeah.
Anywho, I thought I would talk today about Tennessee Volksfest. Yeah. This weekend, September 13th through 14th at the Tennessee Farmers Market. It's free to go, but if you put down $20 before it happens, which means you've got until Saturday, you can get a half-liter mug and 5 tokens, which can be exchanged for food and drink, currywurst, pretzels, Oktoberfest brew. Exciting good times. But I'd also advise that beware with the Oktoberfest-style beer, because last year I drank way too much of it. And apparently a liter of Oktoberfest brew can get me very drunk. It's got a 6% alcohol content as opposed to a beer's typical about 4-ish.
And German beer tends to be.
And I felt every ounce of it. It was great. They're also going to have Volkswagens, new and old. It sounds kind of neat because, Heinz Volksfest, I guess, People's Fest, that kind of thing. Apparently this is the second one. I didn't go to the last one because I hadn't heard of it. Also, I thought it was amusing that the Volksfest and the Oktoberfest is happening in Germantown, which I should advise you go to, too. But I'm probably going to mention that next month as it gets closer to it's amusing that they, both the Nashville Fest actually bracket the German, the one that's actually in Germany is from September 20th to October 5th. Ours is around it. I thought it was amazing.
We don't want to compete with them.
That's
right.
We don't want to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're going to steal their Germanic thunder. We don't want to steal their thunder. They get mad. Gain Z Beer House Oktoberfest. Drinking Z Beer.
That is good, yeah.
Yeah. What you got, Crystal?
All right. There was a whole.
Sorry.
Oh, you got in trouble. Sorry.
There was a hope there might be a few live shows surrounding the Zeppelin reissues. But Robert Plant, he isn't looking back. He is giving us his 10th solo album. It dropped yesterday, and you can place your hold for the physical CD now. It's called Lullaby and the Ceaseless Roar. It was available for streaming last week from NPR, and I gave it a listen. The songs are sorrowful, beautiful, joyful, just the kind of album you'd expect Plant would make after all his travels and life experiences and all the creative efforts thus far.
Critical Rehab.
That's right. I've heard that he and Patty Griffin have ended their romantic relationship, so that means my chances of running into him at the local grocery store have drastically dwindled. Anyway, but I really hope that he takes this album on the road and makes a stop in Nashville. All right, Greg.
Cool. So What's Tickling My Fancy is an illustrator of children's books, a dead Italian one I've never heard of before, called...
That's my favorite guy.
I know, right?
I know so many. Benny Montresor, he does these amazing full-color psychedelic prints that incorporate this really magical storytelling. He won a Caldecott Medal in 1965, but the library doesn't have too many of his books. Check out Hansel and Gretel, which we have, and is also the library's latest puppet show. And you can get a sense for more through outlets like the Internet Archive. And Montresor also had a career as a set designer and won a few Tonys in his day. And I actually came across a CD while browsing through the opera collection at the library, which is a collaboration between Philip Glass and Benny Montresor. Philip Glass obviously did the music, which is a very creepy synthesizer-driven opera. And it also includes in the liner notes the original children's storybook with Montresor's signature psychedelic illustrations. So there's one illustration for each track of the opera. It's about a king who wants a son, and the fairies give him some seeds to grow a son, but he's this weird plant boy hybrid. Then he goes on to live with the witches, and there's sort of this high drama story that ensues. So give it a listen and read it to your children before they go to bed at night.
So I might be a space kid here, but did you actually name the opera?
The opera is The Witches of Venice, I believe.
Huh.
You're probably going to get that wrong. But...
Oh, boy.
I admire your audaciousness for not knowing the title.
That's one way to put it.
I like Philip Glass's operas. I do. First time I heard Einstein on the Beach, it was a complete revelation.
I've been meaning to watch opera, but I've gone around to it.
Don't start with Philip Glass.
Yeah, I get this feeling.
What's opera doc? That's a good place to start.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Reading
yeah.
Minimalist
good.
Composers are a good Carmen. Example of artists that were not maybe accepted when they came out.
You know what's awesome opera? Nixon in China is an amazing, amazing opera.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Who wrote that one?
John Adams.
You don't start there.
Go in the rock opera.
I've seen rock opera. Yeah.
This is flying. You need to walk first. This is flying.
Yeah. Is there like a good starter? I guess Carmen.
Carmen. What,
in John Adams' defense, the minimalism wasn't as radical when the time they got around to writing Nixon in China. There's a lot of regular melodies.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
John Adams is more lyrical than Philip Glass
yeah.
is too.
Because even if you think like Einstein on the Beach is sort of that really classic. Philip Glass, and nothing really happens in that opera.
One, two, three, four.
Exactly.
Five.
So that's like really super duper abstract. Where the music is, I think, relatable or in Nixon in China, but what'll really get you is the fact the score kind of goes all Only God Forgives on. Not the score. The libretto goes very Only God Forgives and gets very symbolic. Goes into this weird dream space.
Yeah, so you need to start with Baby Steps and then do that one.
Yeah, well, that's
something. So another awesome John Adams opera that we have on DVD is, say it for me.
I don't know the title. It's the nuclear bomb one, and I can't think of what's
Dr.
The,
Atomic.
Dr. Atomic.
Dr.
Thank
Atomic.
You.
So it's an opera, cool. An opera about.
It's so good. I know, but you can't start that. That's not what opera. You need to get the Italian opera or French opera base. Then you can do the crazy Americans, and then you can compare and contrast.
I'm trying to give Mike an in.
I wouldn't start at Dr.
For a normal Tom. Person, Italian opera is a good entry.
You need to start with like Carmen or Wagner. Yes, something that
if you're looking.
This is my. You're a nerd. You need to start with Dr. Atomic.
Yeah,
it is
cool.
It is cool, and it's staged really well because we have the Met does it, and then they put out the video, the DVD, and it is really. And it's only like 2 hours long. Like it's not crazy long. Like,
yeah, okay.
I think is that right? Is what 2 hours? It's not. I mean, it's not like you have to like build a tent and get comfortable and.
Yeah, yeah. Like with some of them Wagner stuff. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I'm not sure I'm into the Lee Blooming Light or whatever.
No.
But why not? Because I mean, it's like it's kind of fantasy.
It sounds cool. It's just that you know it's supposed to take a place. It takes 3 days to make or something.
So you just, you know, a little bit, one act at a time.
What else
are
you going to do?
think of how many hours of, like, some crappy TV show you didn't even like. It's like, well, I guess I'll finish all 8 seasons.
I guess.
Right? So, like, you could listen to one opera even though it's long. That's all I'm saying.
I think you should start with Chinese opera. Person. Beijing opera.
Yeah, those have kung fu in them, don't they?
Occasionally, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where Jackie Chan learned his moves, the Beijing opera.
Yeah. A lot of awesome costumes, too.
So tickling my fancy this week is actually what was tickling my fancy 3 weeks ago. And for the Shakespeare in the Park episode, I had talked about this movie called Titus. And, you know, I thought for sure the library had copies, but the library had no copies.
Mm.
But now the library does have copies.
Yay.
So I'm going to just go back and take the segment that we cut and put it back in. But it fits really, really nicely because... Currently, on Rotten Tomatoes, the movie Titus has a 68% critics rating, which isn't really that good, but an 86% audience rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So people like it, and I like it too. And right here, I just go off on how much I like it.
I really like it.
It's the best. Titus is rightest with me.
We have not also mentioned Kenneth Branagh, who owns Shakespeare movies, I think.
I would offer an alternative to that opinion, and that is the films of Julie Taymor. She's done 2 feature film versions of Shakespeare plays, Titus Andronicus and The Tempest. And Titus Andronicus, when it was released in the theater, just had the title Titus, and it's one of Shakespeare's earlier plays. It's not as well known because it's actually so violent and filled with revenge. So it's about this Roman general Titus, played by Anthony Hopkins, who returns home to Rome with Tamora, the queen of the Goths, in tow with Jessica Lange as Tamora. In an act of mercy, Tamora is allowed to live, but she schemes against Titus, marries the young Roman emperor Saturnius, played by Alan Cumming, who I talked about on last week's podcast. And of course, she does get revenge on Titus, but then Titus gets revenge on her. And it is gruesome and sexy and wonderful and unlike any Shakespeare adaptation I've ever seen before. She kind of mashes together different times in this movie. So it's set in Rome, but it's highly stylized and very surreal. And there's all these elements of contemporary history that you will see, but it still uses Shakespearean language. There's a lot of murder and rape and dismemberment and cannibalism in this movie.
Crying puppy face.
crying puppy face. And I think that
puppy face.
Like, Hopkins is self-conscious that in a lot of ways what he's sort of doing is high-arting, if that's a word, his Hannibal Lecter performance in The Silence of the Lambs. And what I think Tamora does way better than Branagh is she creates like a 3D space, like a world, where with Branagh, it seems like to me like he's just filming a play. And if I was wanted to watch a filmed play, I would watch one of the BBC versions that Bill mentioned. Because like, oh, this is how you do this. What Tamora does, not only does it seem like a film, but it's a very unique film that's unlike any experience. And it's so surreal and scary, I would say that it's almost a horror movie without being a horror movie. There are some really horrific images in this movie. I'm just going to go there. It's not only like my favorite Shakespeare interpretation, it's actually one of my favorite movies. I think it's really underrated. And to quote one of my favorite film writers, William Chamberlain, I really like a hard R. And Titus is really a hard R. And then, of course, you might have heard of Julie Taymor. She's actually more well-known in the world of theater. She directed a little musical you might have heard of called The Lion King. So it's probably the most successful.
Which is also loosely based on Hamlet.
Good tie-in. We could have totally nerded out on movies that are based on Shakespeare, right?
She also did all the awesome costumes and puppets that make that show what it is.
Yeah. She's, you know what, I think that the film world has a bias against her because her background is so rooted in theater, and I think that there's a Hollywood fraternity, and she's a woman, and she's also from the theater world, so I don't think her films get as much credit as films as they deserve, in my opinion. More famously, maybe this is a negative thing, but she was the director of the Spider-Man musical.
I knew that name was familiar. This whole time I'm like, Julie Taymor, whoever heard that. So
she got fired from that because of creative differences with other people involved. Now, since then, the Spider-Man musical went on to make a ton of money, and I think it won some Tonys. And she sued, and she said, you kicked me off of this, but I developed this musical, and you got to give me some money. So now, every time that that's open, she gets a check. Every week that that's open on Broadway, she gets a kickback, even though she was fired.
We have a book on that play by one of the writers that I've been meaning to read for the past, year, detailing some of the bonkers behind the scenes.
Remind me, who are the forces that came in and sort of took over that production?
I don't know. You know, I just...
Somebody, sort of famous and famously bad.
You know, the people that wrote the music were U2. It was Bono and Edge.
Maybe it's
U2.
And you know, he doesn't get his powers through a radioactive spider. He gets his powers from the mythological figure Arachne. You know, who comes forward in time is all like Peter Parker. Here, have superpowers. Thanks, mythological figure Arachne. I guess.
And that's Julie Taymor.
Oh.
Through and through. For sure.
That could be cool, I guess.
No.
Depending on how it's done.
But she also did that. I really enjoy it. Selma Hayek, the famous painter.
Frida.
That's a good movie. Yeah, she did that.
She's awesome.
She did Across the Universe, which is not super awesome, but it's very visually awesome.
Is it visually awesome? Yeah, plot needed a little work.
Yeah, so one of the rumors kind of swirled around, and I think it echoes Mike's sentiments that Tamora, though a brilliant creative mind, didn't understand comic books. So they kicked her off the musical and added some extra creative consultants. And one of the extra creative consultants was Roberto Aguirre Sacasa, whose name you might recall from the Afterlife with Archie review that Jeremy did for the blog. And I think that was to make it maybe a little less mythological and more comic booky. But she still gets credit as the director.
But that does sound better than the 1970s TV movies, Spider-Man, which, you know, when I was a kid was all you could see of live-action Spider-Man. So I think in Addams Family Values, that's the play that Wednesday and Pugsley do in front of the summer camp. That they had she gets her hands cut off and she does a speech, and I think that's from Titus Andronicus.
Yes.
Okay, I knew it was Shakespeare, but I didn't know.
And she sprays the blood on the whole audience. I love that movie.
The
scene in Titus, well, she's raped, and they cut her hands off, and they cut her tongue out. And speaking of lower classes, so it's believed that this play is one of these early Shakespeare plays, that it's so violent and horrible because
he was really young when he wrote it.
He's pandering to a popular audience, and these revenge plays were popular at the time. And in the Victorian era, it was like, yeah, that's bad. That's not good. We're just going to forget about that play. Right. But anyway, the scene in Taymor's version, she gets her hands cut off and they shove sticks right in her wrists, and they cut her tongue out, and they tie her to a tree in like this middle of a swamp. And she's framed like classically from far away in the middle, and they find her and they're like, oh my God, what happened to you? What's wrong? I'm sorry, I can't do the Shakespeare lines. You know what I mean? And she's not talking and they can't figure out why, you know? And then it zooms to close up, and she tries to speak, and in slow motion, all the blood comes out of her mouth, and it's the most horrific, surreal image I've ever seen. Jesus. You know, yeah. It's like,
I guess I'm a terrible person, but I certainly want to put this on hold.
I'm telling you, this is the coolest movie, and I'm just gonna go there. Jessica Lange is sexy as hell in this movie, like just like evil and sexy. It's great. I love this movie. Like.
She was the queen.
She's the queen of the Goths, mm-hmm. who begs for mercy and then seduces the young emperor and revenges the Titus, the Roman emperor, the Roman general that captured her. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing movie. And then, of course, at the end, I don't want to give too much away, but he, after his daughter is raped and murdered, he gets his revenge in a scene that you will never forget at the end. You will never forget, right? Yeah.
There's also another thing you're talking about. The cinematographer on this movie was Lucio Tavoli, mm-hmm. who also filmed all of Argento's films, like Suspiria. Ooh. And those
yeah. Interesting.
Okay. This, I can't say it enough. This is one of my favorite movies ever. This is, I just think it's a transcendent work of art. Okay, I'm done being a fanboy. Though, this idea came up. I heard this concept on the radio. A nerd is someone that wants to share what they love, whether you want to know about it or not. But a hipster is someone that wants to know about stuff, but then keep it all to themselves.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if that's true, but it's an interesting concept. It's thought-provoking.
I thought hipsters were like ironically liking. They don't like anything. They just ironically like things. Oh, I totally love this jacket.
Or they don't like anything. Yeah,
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 they
don't,
they don't like
actually
it.
Like
they
anything.
Like, I have a lot of friends that just hate everything. It's like,
you know,
I was that way through most of my 20s. Yeah. You know, if we were doing this podcast, you know, 10 years ago, I would have recommended 4 movies and then quit because there's nothing else.
I did take this opportunity to diss Kenneth Branagh's version of Shakespeare, which everybody else loves. Right? Corrections! The Grimes video for Go actually came out the day that we recorded, and from then and now, it has 1 million views. I feel the same way about it as I do about the song itself. The film adaptation of Sister Carrie, maybe this isn't a correction, but a follow-up.
Follow-up.
Came out in 1952. It was directed by someone named William Wyler.
I don't know.
You're right. And starred someone named Laurence Olivier or something.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And it's on
Zeus himself.
It's on Hoopla.
But it's called just Carrie. Like, it's just Carrie, right? It's not Sister Carrie. It's just
you,
Carrie.
Yeah, you are correct.
Okay.
Like it's as just, in Carrie?
As in Carrie.
Only.
Yeah, yes, not right. Just Carrie.
And we
just space Carrie.
We went through the minus pig's blood bit last time.
Yeah, yeah. There was a whole thing about pig's blood last time. And Jennifer Jones played the lead. I'm assuming she plays Carrie.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, Jennifer
yeah,
Jones.
Look, a good
yeah,
movie.
Morticia.
So, I believe it was nominated for some Oscars, right? So Jennifer Jones, Laurence Olivier, and William Wyler.
And I think we
I
have
totally
it here.
This.
I haven't watched it yet. Or maybe we used to have
we
it.
We have right? it on the Hoopla.
The Hoopla, okay.
The Hoopla.
So
So you can spin it around your waist. Wait, I'm confused.
I'm good at that.
So the author from the Midwest that I talked about, Tom Drury, he is from Iowa.
Oh, yeah.
And for a number of years, he was a newspaper man.
Uh-huh.
You know, so just like, you know, Dreiser. Maybe we need to check that out. Greg said that he and I play Settlers of Catan every day, but...
Every other day.
Settlers, that's what we do when we first get to work. But Settlers of Catan actually takes more than two people to play.
Aww.
So,
that's why your game goes so long.
I thought that the 5 hours to play a single game thing was the giveaway that maybe you guys were fiddling.
Well, I mean, of course I know that, but I didn't want to out anyone else.
Karen plays with us.
It's Karen.
She's tough, too.
So, I think with that, we have crossed into nitpicking territory, but... okay, but just
you do a whole episode on things I've said.
ding!
Correction for me.
So,
oh, wow.
You said that Iggy Azalea was from New Zealand. Actually, she's from Australia.
Oh, no.
That's
fighting words.
That's not...
Yeah, according to Fly of the Conchords, I'd be burned in effigy.
Exactly. That's not the same. But in your defense, I think when you were speaking, the whole idea of what you were saying was, I don't know anything about her, right?
Huzzah!
So,
my ignorance makes it win yet again.
Yeah, so like a typical ugly American, you mixed up New Zealand and Australia and pissed off both countries. So, all right.
Awesome. No more kiwi for you.
Totally different kind of sheep farmer.
and for more information about that kind of thing, you can go to
library.
www.
You don't have to type
library.
national.org.
So for a while, on certain versions of certain internet browsers, you did have to type www.
Is like, it official across the board now?
I
don't think you do anymore.
I hope.
No, you don't in Chrome.
I hope that in all internet browsers, you don't have to type www. But man, you know, I've had so much fun making you guys say that.
It's our thing.
www.
Sounds like a wrestling organization. And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Adam Dean.
Not Paula Dean.
Talking about?
I mean, you could at least use it for an art project or something.
Yeah, right.
Line your bird cage.
There you go.
Pages.
I don't know. It may fall over like a cockatoo. Was it the canary in the coal mines?
That's a good one. The book is so bad that the pages kill the bird and they line my bird cage.
Yeah.
How bad is it?
That's really bad.
I used it as toilet paper, but I got a rash.
this book is so bad.
That should be a library sanctioned event, like book trash talking.
Yes.
I've got good news. That the mule wash is going to. come back in style. She's my cousin. But doesn't she look almost exactly like Laura Palmer?
But it is Laura Palmer. Are you Laura Palmer?
I feel like I know her. But sometimes my arms bend back. She's filled with features. Where we're from, the birds sing a freshly song. And there's always music in the air.